Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
The hunt for alien worlds and planets like our own. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. Scientists are on the hunt for exoplanets, planets that exist outside our solar system. So far, they found thousands of planets orbiting other stars and some that might be like our own world. That means they could have all the prerequisites to life as we know it here on Earth. We'll talk with two scientists leading the hunt for these alien worlds. First, we'll speak with MIT's Dr. George Ricker. He's a research scientist and the principal investigator for NASA's TESS mission, a space-based telescope tasked with identifying possible planets around distant stars. The telescope completed its primary mission after launching from Cape Canaveral back in 2018. Now it's entering its extended mission, aimed to catalog even more exoplanet candidates. We'll speak with Ricker about the mission and the findings so far. Then, Are We There Yet's Kirk Churchill speaks with UCF scientist Dr. Theodora Karlidi about TRAPPIST-1, a system some 39 light-years away that looks similar to our own solar system. Could that mean these planets could support life? The hunt for exoplanets and alien worlds. That's just ahead on Are We There Yet? Here on WMFE, America's Space Station. NASA's TESS telescope is rather small. It's only about the size of a golf cart, but it's making big discoveries. Since its launch on SpaceX's Falcon 9 back in 2018, it has identified thousands of possible exoplanets. Its cameras focus on distant stars and measure a dip in the light when a planet passes in front of it. It's called the transiting method, and scientists have uncovered thousands of exoplanet candidates this way. MIT's Dr. George Ricker leads the TESS mission and joins us now to talk about the mission's next phase. But first, he looks back at the primary test campaign.
Well, it went extremely well. We actually were pleasantly surprised at how sensitive the cameras were, how well the satellite itself behaved. We were expecting to be able to see variations in light that were in the range of maybe 40 or 50 parts per million. And in reality, the sensitivity to small changes in light from stars or the effects of the planets transiting their host stars was about five times better than that. And to give you an idea of what that means, if a planet the size of our Earth transits across or casts a shadow on the sun, that diminution in brightness that you get from the sun is about 85 parts per million. So TESS is able to look at effects like that. That would correspond to very small planets. In fact, TESS could actually detect a planet only the size of the moon transiting across, or the size of our sun. So we made these measurements so that we actually covered the southern hemisphere of the sky in the first year and the northern hemisphere in the second year. And altogether, we discovered more than 2,000. New planet candidates that have subsequently been studied to establish what their masses were. These range all the way from planets the size of Jupiter to planets that are quite a bit smaller than the Earth, and they have orbital periods that range from a few days for the planets that are very close to their host star to periods of several months among the ones that we saw. And we're really pleased about the tremendous number that we were able to find and also the quality. And going into the new extended mission that we're in now, we're able to increase that number of 2,000, probably by as much as a factor of 10, because going to be looking at about 50 million stars over the next 2 years, because since the instruments are so stable, as I mentioned before, that means that we can actually look for many smaller planets than we thought was possible. And then the other thing that we're actually finding in the tests is that, as you might expect from our solar system, where there are eight planets, there are a lot of multi-planet systems that we're finding. A lot of these are kind of odd. I mean, in our solar system, for example, you've got the four inner planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, that are small and rocky. And then there's gaseous planets in the outer solar system, Jupiter, Saturn, Neptune, and Uranus. Well, the curious thing about many of the systems that we're finding with TESS is they're sort of turned upside down. That is, the big planets are on the inside of the system, and then the rocky planets are on the outside. And some of them actually are packed in very closely to their host star, and some are spread further apart. But it's a very interesting discovery that these systems are so different from what we see in our own solar system.
50 million stars in this next campaign. That seems like a huge amount of data. How do you sift through all this stuff? Does someone actually have to look at all of these light readings and see where the dips are on all of these observations on all these different stars? How do you actually parse through all this data?
Well, it's quite a challenge, and we certainly couldn't do it all manually and by eye. So it's a combination of several things. Some of the signatures for the dips associated with the planets are recognizable by a special computer system that we've assembled and special programs. And we're also starting to use AI and machine learning to pick up some of these signals. So it's a combination of both things. The quantity of data is really enormous because, you know, the number that I mentioned before, 100 megabits per second, is what we get from the satellite when it passes close enough to the Earth to do a data downlink using NASA's Deep Space Network. And we have to scramble to actually get the data together into a form that we can actually analyze, and then calibrate it, and then go through the process of sifting the data, and then look for the candidates that look promising and carry out measurements on the ground from ground-based systems that will allow us to enable their to find their masses. And in so doing, we've actually been able to bring together a team of about 500 astronomers on that are spread at observatories around the world. There's more than 100 observatories that are involved in this effort, and so everyone has really been doing a great job to harvest this data and to try to do really. It's really like you could think of it as kind of a census, and we had a So just like the U.S. Census, there's a finite period of time that we have to go through the data and sift through it and figure out what type of planets are orbiting around which types of stars. And then some observatories are better at looking at large planets, and some are better at looking at small planets. And so there's a lot of coordination and follow-up work that we've had to do along those lines. So it's been a hectic time, but it's been an exciting time, and everyone who's been involved in it is just really anxious if we can keep going further and further as we go along. And then the other thing, and this is something else that's happened in the mission that we've really been excited about going forward, is that we're discovering a lot of exoplanets, but we're also finding a lot of other things in the sky that sort of go bump in the night. For example, we've discovered one example, now there's actually two, of things that are called tidal disruption events. And this is a something that happens well outside of our galaxy. In fact, it actually, the one that we saw actually occurred in a place in the sky that we were staring at for about 7 months, and there was not much going on in terms of when we were certainly discovering exoplanets there. But what we actually saw was there was an area in a relatively inconspicuous galaxy that just brightened up all of a sudden. And over a period of a day, it brightened by more than a factor of 1,000. And in so doing, one of the things that we were able to establish was that this was that this particular galaxy had a supermassive black hole that was had a mass, maybe between 100 million and a billion times that of our sun in its core. And the behavior that we actually saw with TESS was a star that unfortunately got too close to that black hole, and it was actually shredded, and it was just ripped apart in its entirely, and then spread as hot gas that was emitting X-rays and light and a whole range of electromagnetic radiation over the time that we were looking at it. And this was the first time that astronomers had actually been able to see the early hours of an event like that. And then after we were able to transmit this information to other observers, there were lots of other satellites that actually got to the object while it was still bright enough. In fact, there was an early ground-based observatory that saw the object brighter it was about a week or so after it went off. And then we looked back in the TESS data and actually saw the turn on. So it was, so in that sense, TESS was actually keeping a record of everything that it saw. And that meant that other observers could in a sense go back and look at these types of unknown events and see if there's a correlation with what TESS is actually seeing. And this has happened for other events too, supernovae, which are objects that are also extragalactic, are being detected by TESS at the rate of about 100 per year. And these are particularly bright ones, and they're the ones that astronomers can study the best.
As you mentioned, the TESS is now in its extended mission. The next phase of the mission will be more community-focused. What does that mean?
What we've been able to do with TESS, and this has made our jobs harder, but on the other hand, it's been very rewarding. NASA has actually instituted what's called a guest investigator program. And this is an arrangement whereby people can actually propose objects or candidates that TESS can potentially look at. And then NASA, for the investigators, will actually provide funding for them to take the TESS data that comes in. These are people who are not part of the original team, and then fund their analyses and interpretation of TESS data. And that program now is fully underway. And the thing that's unusual about the way that TESS is operating is that in the extended mission, 100% of the data is actually based on targets that are presented by the community. And then the ones of objects that have been previously discovered will continue to be looked at in preparation for the launch of the James Webb Space Telescope, which is coming up hopefully toward the end of this year. So there's a lot of preparatory work that's part of that. So basically, you know, we had this phrase that we used in the early days of TESS when we were making the arrangements with NASA to have the mission approved, is we referred to TESS as the people's telescope. And it's really turned out to be that way, because there's so much data that TESS produces that literally thousands of astronomers, and for that matter, high school students, citizen scientists, amateur astronomers, all there are just lots and lots of people that are going to the TESS data archive and looking at the images and looking at the light curves. Many people, for example, who are interested in variable stars, there's been a long tradition in astronomy for amateurs to look at, to observe and to look and interpret the light changes that occur in stars that are variable on time scales of hours, days, weeks, whatever. And TESS is unique in that it provides data for that in a way that's not interrupted by bad weather or day-night cycles or whatever. And there's an enormous amount of basic new astrophysical information that's being gleaned from these observations that are that many of the community astronomers are making available as well. And this also means that it isn't that TESS is doing everything. TESS sometimes is providing the identification of a unique new system. And then even when it moves on in the sky to look at other parts of the sky as the year goes on, many ground-based astronomers, for example, can continue to follow up these objects, both then and also in future years.
Fascinating stuff. Well, we've been speaking with George Ricker. He's a senior research scientist at MIT and the principal investigator for NASA's TESS mission. Dr. Ricker, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much. It's nice to speak with you again, Brendan.
There is a lot more to that conversation. Visit WMFE.org/space for the full interview. Still to come, could a star system nearly 40 light years away have planets like our own Earth? And could it support life? Are we there yet? It's back in a minute. You're listening to Are We There Yet on WMFE, America's Space Station. I'm Brendan Byrne. 39 million light years away, a system of seven rocky worlds orbit a faint star called TRAPPIST-1. Using a variety of space telescopes to observe the system, scientists think that these planets might have an atmosphere closely resembling our own, which makes this an intriguing finding in the search for life on other worlds. To talk more about the TRAPPIST-1 star system, Are We There Yet's Kirk Churchill spoke with UCF scientist Dr. Theodora Carlidi about what we know about the star system and its unique Earth-like qualities. And a note for our listeners, UCF is a financial supporter of this show.
Dr. Carlidi, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
The TRAPPIST system is pretty far away from Earth, almost 40 light years away. And with the system so far away, how do we end up discovering it in the first place?
So the system was first observed with a ground-based telescope, TRAPPIST. That's why it's also named TRAPPIST-1 in Chile. And initially, we knew of three planets around the TRAPPIST-1 star. And then the unfortunately by now dead Spitzer Space Telescope went back and observed it again and found that we actually had seven planets there, which made it really exciting. And the way we discover these planets is by just continuously staring at stars and waiting to see if an eclipse happens. The idea is really similar to kind of what happens when we have a sun eclipse. You probably have experienced one yourself, right? In our case, the moon goes in between the sun and the Earth and blocks the sun. It just so happens by a fluke of nature that the moon is just big enough and just at the right distance that it can sometimes completely cover the sun disk. But in some cases, it's just not at the right geometry and just further away. So you just get part of the sun disk covered and then you kind of lose part of the sunlight, but just not all of it. And that's really what we see for planets around other stars, like the TRAPPIST-1 system, because they're really small in comparison to their parent star. Even though TRAPPIST-1 is a small star, they just pass in front of it and we see some light missing suddenly from the star. And by keep on observing, we see that there is actually a repetitiveness in the light that we're missing. So we know there's a planet in orbit around it. And by seeing more of these dips, we can find that there's more planets out there.
Being so far away and looking at these observations, how do we know there's a potential for water on the surface of some of these planets? And what does that mean in terms of possibility of life on TRAPPIST or even other worlds outside of our own?
So there's a couple of things that are involved when we talk about the potential of water. So the first thing is we're looking at the planet and trying to figure out if it's at the right distance from the parent star. Not too cold, so not too far away, not too hot, so not too close by, so that liquid water can actually exist on the surface. This is what we call the habitable, or sometimes you may hear it as a Goldilocks zone. Similarly, basically to kind of what you would have, say, being around a fire pit, right? If you're too close to a fire pit and a cold night, you probably feel too hot. You want to go further out to be pleasant, and that's what happens with the planet. It just needs to be far out enough to be pleasant enough on the surface for liquid water there. For TRAPPIST, we have three planets from the seven that we think are in about the right distance for liquid water to be on the surface. However, something to keep in mind is that just the right distance is not enough. We also need to have a good atmosphere around the planet. And that is where big telescopes like the Hubble or the hopefully soon to be launched James Webb Space Telescope come in action. And what we're doing with these telescopes is that we are looking at these planets and try to figure out if there is an atmosphere to start with. And if so, can we see the absorption signatures from or emission signatures from the right elements, like, say, water in the atmosphere, oxygen, maybe some ozone, all things that actually are really important for life as we know it to exist there.
So as far as the actual maybe surface of the planet itself, or surface of the planets and those within the system, based off of the current predictions, do we have a general idea of what the surface of some of these planets look like besides the potential for holding water?
So we know based on some of the observations we have so far that most of them are probably rocky in composition. And that is true for pretty much all of the planets in that system. Unlike our solar system, where we have the four rocky planets inwards and the four gaseous planets outside, that system is really compact and also really rocky, it seems. But in order to figure out, we have some ideas that probably there could be water on the surfaces, but in order to figure that out, we're going to need the next generations of telescopes, James Webb, and even further in the future to really be able to map the surfaces eventually. I just want to mention that I think one of the most interesting thing for the TRAPPIST systems, in my perspective, is probably not how the surfaces really look like, but the fact that if you were actually there and you would look up in the night sky, you would be able to see a lot of the neighboring planets because they're just so close by one to another that you would be able to see them like really pretty moons on your sky. And that makes it really interesting.
Absolutely. Sounds like quite a sight that maybe one day in the very, very far future, our great, 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 great grandchildren may or may not get to experience. But so looking at that with data collection, right, understanding more about the system, you've mentioned there's a series of telescopes and other things that are being utilized in order to study more about this. Is there other ways that data collection is going to occur to learn more about these systems besides the use of telescopes?
Telescopes are, because these planets are so far away from us, the only information we can get from them is the light they are either emitting themselves or they're reflecting, or say in the case of the TRAPPIST-1 system, they're blocking from their parent star. So telescopes are really the only way we can get any information on these systems.
In terms of its discovery, right, the system, as we've kind of talked about throughout the episode, is extremely far away. What does TRAPPIST discovery mean for science, and what benefit do we gain from studying more about this star system?
So I think generally finding more planets out there was quite a breakthrough for science. If you think of the fact that for thousands of years, we just knew about our own little neighborhood here in the solar system. And actually for most of these past thousands of years, we even didn't know all of our neighbors. Some of the gaseous planets or even Pluto were discovered pretty recently, actually, even though Pluto is not a planet anymore, but still in our neighborhood, right? And we were just using kind of these planets to try to figure out how the planets came to be, why is Earth as it is with liquid water and life, while Venus is scorching hot and Mars is pretty much a desolated desert by now. And by finding other planets out there, we actually started having more examples of how planets can be and how some of the properties depend on their parent star. And we started getting a better understanding of how our solar system came to be and why we are here. So a system like the TRAPPIST-1, for example, being a multiple planet system with seven planets can give us some comparison to our own solar system, even though it's in such a different scale that our system is right now. Also, TRAPPIST, I think, is really interesting because it can offer us an opportunity to potentially have another planet out there that can host water on the surface and even maybe life, even though that's a really big discussion of how do we figure out what life signatures are. And so far in our whole solar system, the Earth is the only planet that has liquid water on the surface. We do have some moons further out around Saturn and Jupiter that have liquid oceans underneath, thick ice surfaces. We even have a really intriguing moon with lakes of methane. But there's nothing else like the Earth with liquid water on the surface and the perfect place for life to thrive. So I think by studying a model like the TRAPPIST system, we just get a bit closer to trying to figure out if we're really so special here on Earth and eventually try to answer the big question that we're all after, that are we alone in the universe?
That was Are We There Yet's Kirk Churchill speaking with UCF's Dr. Theodore Carlidi. Well, that's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to this show's podcast feed and never miss an episode. Do that on NPR One, iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Are We There Yet? It's a production of WMFE, America's Space Station. Editorial guidance this week from Matthew Petty. Our intern is Kirk Churchill, and our director of content is Steve Yasko. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. You can make a financial contribution to this show by visiting WMFE.org. or call 1-800-785-2020. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.